Hello listeners and welcome to another episode where we play you some of our favourite bits from Not Enough Champagne's episodes from last year. There's three clips we're going to play for you. The first is from April last year, in which we look back on 20 years after New Labour first took power. That features Labour councillors Bridget Jones and John Cotton, as well as Chair of Birmingham Fabian's Luke John Davis. The second also features Bridget and is about research into the different types of head teachers and how successful they are. And the third clip on this episode discusses research into the different attitudes generations have to looking after the elderly. But I'll start after this rather funky piece of music. So in preparation for this podcast, I reread Chris Mullin's diaries. Chris Mullin was the chair of the Home Affairs Select Committee and was a junior minister. And in it, he quotes an article by, of all people, Andrew Gilligan, that New Labour was a moderately successful social democratic party. So why then are they so hated?
Iraq?
I think it's a combination of the three I's that we haven't been given for: Iraq, immigration and inequality. One of the issues with Iraq was that we went with WMD's claim rather than with the kind of genocide that Saddam Hussein was committing. So that's been one thing. And I think the fact that we haven't stopped attacking our own government. For all of the disaster that John Major presided over, you never heard the Conservatives slagging him off.
I'd go for a slightly different three I's. I'd go for Iraq, infighting and impossible expectations. Iraq, we all know the story there. The infighting was terrible towards the end. The last couple of years, maybe, of Blair's premiership were blighted by infighting and the question of when will he go. And then impossible expectations. You know, Labour had come in after a very long period of Conservative government in the same way as hopes were incredibly high for Obama. We've seen recently hopes were incredibly high for Labour. There was no way they could possibly deliver on every hope that was pinned on them. And they were bound to disappoint in some way.
There's real irony there in that there was an awful lot of trying to manage expectations in the run-up to 97. You know, having gone through four defeats, trying not to frighten the horses, as it were. So, you know, really trying to manage expectations down to the five things on the pledge card. But you're quite right, it was almost like a dam broke. Partly, the victory was so wide-ranging, you know, such a landslide. Then all these expectations have been pent up for many years, kind of broke out. And we were kind of ill-prepared, I think, to deal with that. And we were still in a rather small-c conservative mindset about how to govern. And the expectations massively outstripped what we then went on to do.
And I suppose the problem is you've got such a wide range of voters who are voting for you. Mm. You're going to disappoint some of them. The hardcore Labour vote, you've got your white working class. You've also got people in places like Hove who've probably never voted Labour before. Some seats never went Labour until 1997. And it's an impossible coalition to keep together.
And there's never the expectation, I think, that we'd win on that scale. So, you know, I think the moment when we won Hove, there were people wandering around the election party I was at going, we've won Hove, this is just bloody impossible. Certainly, if you read the diaries, that was echoed on the plane journey they were having down to London, where it's like, you know, you're taking the mick now. We can't possibly have won these places. We were handed such a mandate, we hadn't prepared for the scale of a victory like that and the expectations it unleashed.
Well, we later found out we prepared for a Lib Dem coalition. That's how different the expectations were.
It's really impossible to underestimate just how scarred that generation of Labour leaders was by the experience of the 80s and the experience of losing four elections in a row. So we had, you know, almost present the smallest possible target. I mean, it's the classic Roy Jenkins phrase, isn't it, when he described Blair as carrying the ornate vase across a highly polished floor and hoping he doesn't drop it. And that really, I think, governed the mindset, certainly of the early part of that Labour government.
There's a quote in one of Chris Mullin's diaries where someone says, to understand Blair, you've got to understand that he comes from Hackney in the 80s, which is basically the point of view that the Labour Party is always wrong. Actually, Blair was proved wrong in that view over Iraq, where he goes into Iraq, most Labour members don't want it. A lot of Labour MPs don't want it. He manages to, as the Chilcot inquiry basically says, manages to shackle himself very, very closely to who we all thought was going to be the most disastrous US president of our lifetimes before, you know, everything else.
And those were the days.
oh, for a statesman in the White House.
It is worth remembering, though, that Blair did win a fairly decent majority in 2005, 2 years after Iraq.
But Blair, I think, tried to be very, very close to Bush in order to try and influence Bush on Iraq and go through the UN and get any... One of the things that Blair wanted to try and get out of Bush through staying really close to him with the Iraq stuff was a Middle East peace process, which basically got waylaid. There was no planning for what would happen in Iraq after Saddam Hussein left. And also, I slightly disagree with your point, LJ, on responsibility for protect, if only because, actually, if you read the diaries and read the accounts, Blair does do a lot of the moral case for going in and removing dictators. I mean, there was the Chicago speech in 99. Mm. He's going around speaking to Parliament about how Saddam is an evil guy and should be gotten rid of. So I think the case was made.
But that wasn't the main case given at that moment in time. So yeah, absolutely, the Chicago Doctrine, or whatever we call it these days, does definitely focus on that element. But at the end of the day, it was all about that in 45 minutes, they can do this.
I mean, that was certainly the bit that the media picked up on. I think one of the issues around Iraq is you've also got to remember, you talk about where Blair came from and happening in the 80s, but you also have to remember, in terms of international affairs, the two defining international affairs of Blair's early leadership or training was Rwanda and Srebrenica. Both instances, the international community, NATO, was pilloried. And I researched into Responsibility to Protect and the origins of it, where the French rescued the embassy dog and left the Rwandan embassy staff to be massacred. That's the kind of atmosphere in which Blair came to prominence in terms of when he was kind of looking at international affairs. And that was his thing. And also, you know, Sierra Leone, Kosovo, there was examples of successful interventions.
All of this research comes from a Harvard Business Review article that was published a few years ago. They looked at the head teachers of 411 head teachers in academies. And the five types they found, the first type was a surgeon. Now, surgeons tended to be a PE or an RE teacher, and they were tough, they were disciplined. It was all about short-term gain. They would boost exam scores by removing poor performing students, often they'd exclude them from school.
Exactly as you would expect from the PE teacher, not so much the RE teacher.
Mm, I was wondering about this.
I suppose, again, that tends to be the background of where they're studied, but I think, say you've got 411 schools, and there's a little bit of the fallacy of small numbers, where it might seem like there's a disproportionate amount of PE and RE teachers. Don't know how true that is.
I was trying to imagine combining the two.
To be fair, I did actually have a PE and RE teacher at school. They did both, so...
Religious football?
That would have been entertaining.
You could have a really religious sportsman. I mean, David Shepherd played cricket for England in the 60s. He was Bishop of Liverpool. So... He could be an archetype surgeon.
Yeah, and instead of making kids pick their sport teams, you could just divide the kids up into Catholics versus Protestants and get them to play football. What could go wrong?
Glasgow. So surgeons, they're still about boosting exam results in the short term. They put their best teachers into the later years, so it tends to be year 11. They lower class sizes, and they put more time into revision classes. For the 1 or 2 years that those surgeons are at the school, exam results go up quite dramatically for the 1 or 2 years that they're there. Then it falls away. Often after it leaves, you know, these surgeons tend to be ones who go into a school, turn it around quickly. But because the early years are neglected, so in a secondary school, they focus on year 10 and 11 and not year 7, 8 and 9. It's tend to be those years that then, in a few years after when the head teacher leaves, then you see performance drop. And actually, a few years after the surgeons left, the school's in a worse state than it was before they took control. So that's surgeons. The second one, they're called soldiers in this review. Now, they tend to be IT and chemistry teachers.
IT and chemistry, that's a more logical grouping, I suppose. Chemistry is so specific, though. Where do the physics teachers go?
They just didn't become head teachers. They just love physics so much, I'm guessing. They just want to spend all their time doing physics.
I mean,
rather
to be
than
fair,
teaching.
That does fit most of the description of all of my physics teachers at school.
Also, the massive physics teacher shortage. They're probably just not allowed to become head teachers.
Yeah, wouldn't shock me.
Now, soldiers, they're all about cutting costs. It's all about being disciplined on that, which meant that in these schools, the finance was good, but the exam results tended to stay the same. Also, morale in the school completely dropped because staff had very little job security.
and the cuts that the soldiers made were too deep to sustain. So after the soldier leaves, the costs increase again because more staff are brought on to try and fill the void that's there.
I can see a parallel with national government coming.
What subject do you think accountants tended to teach?
Oh, math seems like a too easy. That sounds like the klaxon's going to go off.
No. This isn't QI. the easy.
There's no depth to our general knowledge.
For year, if not enough champagne has taught us anything, so the easy answer is always the correct answer. So, maths teachers, they're called accountants because these head teachers tend to look for new revenue streams. So if it's a secondary school, they might take over a primary school to get a bit more cash. Or they might try and hire the school out to have for conferences and that kind of thing, and leisure facilities. Now, the revenue stream went up in these schools, but the exam results, they stayed the same. So that's accountants. Philosophers tended to be English teachers or tended to be language teachers. They tended to be really interested in teaching. These philosophers, often their parents were teachers, they're really passionate about teaching. There's a big focus on teaching methods in these schools and talking to teachers about the right way to go about it. Really big change in ethos that way. Nothing changes in this school. There's no real evidence that exam scores go up or down in these schools. And a lot of that is because the culture doesn't change. The behaviour in these schools tends to still be quite bad because there's no focus on that. So teachers spend their time managing behaviour rather than teaching, which hampers the progress that's made in those schools. The fifth type of head teacher, they're called the architects. I'm very proud to say, as a history graduate, that these tend to do history degrees or economics. So history, economics teachers. And these tended to work in industry
first.
Now
I understand why you picked this study.
Obviously. It's cherry picking. The other studies said that physics teachers were better, but that's just fake news. So these tended to work in industry first, maybe for 10 or 15 years before. And it's all about creating the right environment. Because they've studied history and economics and not, you know, useless STEM subjects, they know how societies... They know how societies are created, they know how societies are shaped.
It's alright, so, we know how universes are created.
Yeah, that's less useful.
Creating the right environment tended to be through things like putting in a sixth form so that there were career opportunities for older students. Maybe it was creating a relationship with the primary school so that you can have pool resources and expertise in those fields. It could also be improving student behaviour by finding pathways for students who suffer from behaviour. Also, it tended to be improving teaching by introducing coaching programmes or mentoring programmes. Also, a lot of focus on extracurricular things like school trips to boost students learning that way. Schools led by architects, they were the most successful. Although it took 2 or 3 years to lead to improvements, these improvements tended to be bigger than in other schools, and they also tended to be more long-lasting. So after an architect had left the school, the improvements still carried on years after they'd left, unlike surgeons, say, where these performances would drop off. So, of those five different types, who do you think get the most recognition and who gets the least recognition?
Well, I'm very much hoping that your most effective architects are getting the recognition, and not just because you're staring at me, Corey. But I've got a horrible feeling it's not that.
I was going to say, my guess is that it's probably going to be the ones that don't make much of an impact at all, either one way or another. It's going to be
the flash-in-the-pan people.
Well, no, I was going to say that the philosophers who come in because they're the ones that really value their colleagues, and therefore they're the sorts of people who get recommended for lots of things.
Oh no, my money's on the first type, the quick boost in exam results, bugger off, collect your paycheck, and let it all come crashing down after you've left. That's where my money is.
Well, actually, you're both right, which is nice and yet terrible for our education system. So, philosophers tend to be the most frequently appointed, as you alluded to, Steve. So, out of the 411 heads, 161 of those were classed as philosophers. And they tended to get the biggest number of honours. So 30% of those heads, they tended to have an MBE or a CBE or a knighthood. But these were the worst performing schools, both in terms of kind of cost per pupil, but also in terms of development and exam grades and what have you.
Gives new meaning to the various services to education.
And also to Philosopher King, I think. Plato's Republic in action. Or inaction. Surgeons tended to be the ones most honoured in terms of the number of people who had CBEs and MBEs and knighthoods. But the schools that they as we said, those after the surgeon leaves the school, the performance drops off, and the school has long-term problems. And the Harvard Business Review article says that on average in those schools, $2 million, so I'm guessing that's what, about £1.5 million, that's £1.5 million paid to consultants to sort out the problems in those schools after the surgeon leaves. And the architects, as you say, they're unnoticed. And partly they're noticed because they tend to be outsiders, they tend to have worked outside education before coming in. One philosopher head teacher that the Harvard Business Review interviewed for the article, they said, well, you can't run a school unless you've taught for 20 years. Now, what this article demonstrates is that... One interesting thing that's come up through various social attitude surveys over the past year or so is the change in attitudes among a lot of the British public to helping pensioners. So, for instance, in 1996, 69% of people thought that the government should provide a decent standard of living for the elderly. And by 2016, that number's dropped quite dramatically to 52%, so a 17% drop. What do you think explains that?
I think part of it will be just down to the fact that, to a certain degree, definitions of what constitutes a decent standing of living have changed, but primarily it's just the fact that more pensioners have what is considered a decent standard of living. It seems a bit odd, but actually kind of declining numbers in that kind of question on polling normally indicates a less of a focus rather than, you know, a shift in belief that, you know, it's fine for pensioners to be in poverty. If you ask any individual, should anyone live in poverty, chances are they'll say no, unless they're possibly Philip Davies or Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Or Paul Ryan, maybe.
Ryan. But for the most part, people don't hold those sorts of views. Everybody thinks poverty is a bad thing, and everybody would agree that helping people who are in poverty is a good thing. The issue is just that as a certain problem, like, say, let's use pensioner poverty as an example, becomes less and less obvious, not to say it doesn't still happen, but it's not as bad as it used to be, people's focuses change. So if we were to start to see stories about how old people were now much more likely to be living in poverty, how they were barely able to keep the lights on or eat, you would quickly find those numbers spike up again. Again, that wouldn't necessarily mean beliefs have changed in that regard. It just means the focus has shifted and people are more considering that to be a more important policy area.
So that's basically the idea of public opinion as a thermostat, as some political scientists have said. Mm-hmm. So the idea being that, it's as you say, it's not that people don't care about standard of living of old people. It's more that they think that at the moment, the standard of living of the elderly is fine. And a lot of that is because of stuff the government has done, like free travel, winter fuel allowance, that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Effectively, what people actually hear or read when they're asked that question isn't, you know, do you think pensioners should live in poverty? It's, do you think the government should be doing more to help pensioners?
There's a different context. So 20 years ago, pensioner poverty was a massive issue, and mm-hmm. that's one of the reasons why New Labour put a lot of money into it. I think especially politically, it was the 50p pension rise was one of the things that hit Labour politically in its first year in office, and there was that famous example of the pensioner who wrote a cheque to the government for its 50 pence and the government ended up cashing it. But what is an issue is the social care crisis, which that figure seems to ignore. And it's interesting how somehow maybe pensioners who receive social care don't seem to be part of that group.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a couple of reasons for that, but I think the primary one is that the way we talk about social care is never really in conjunction with pensioners. Yes, pensioners are the ones who tend to get the most use out of social care, but we always tend to talk about it in conjunction with things like health, dementia, or, you know, certain health and medical conditions. So it gets wrapped up in a much wider debate on health policy, I'd say, than actually being concerned with, say, policies surrounding OAPs, even though it should be. So I think if you were to ask the right kind of questions, you would certainly find that people do care about those things. For the most part, the kind of the media and political framing around those issues is one either of, just going off things I've seen for myself, it's either to do with devolution of power, it's either to do with healthcare as a wider thing, it's to do with mental health, which is the thing you will often find a lot of social care discussions in relation to as well.
So note to John Curtis and other people on the British Social Attitude Survey who produce the figures that we're talking about.
And just know so much more about this than I'm teaching them to suck eggs.
Ask the right questions next year.
Clearly.
We can mansplain data collection and polling to John Curtis, can't we?
Yeah, clearly.
Hope you enjoyed that. We'll be back with some other episodes either in the week or Sunday, depending on how quick it takes to get our editing act together. Our theme tune is Plucky Good Times by Dave Depper, and James Cram designed our logo. And in fact, James got married last week to Claire, so congratulations to you both. You can follow me on Twitter at Paperback Writer, and Steve is at Acoustic Radical. Happy plotting.